Hello, my name is James Malarker, and you can call me Jim. And welcome to the first episode of An Angry Boomer's Take. With An Angry Boomer's Take, I would like to explore numerous topics from the perspective of a baby boomer. I know the younger generations are often denigrating baby boomers, but they don't realize and or respect the boomers' unique historical perspective, which came through their own firsthand experiences of the last 7, 8, or even 9 decades, and also through the many stories they were told by their parents and grandparents' firsthand experiences, often dating as far back as the beginning of the 1900s. I am currently 68 years old. I'm married with 2 adult children, and my first grandchild is on the way. My wife and I are both retired, somewhat. I proudly admit I am a baby boomer, having been born in early 1957, some 12 years after the end of World War II. My father was a bit older when I was born. He was 40, having been born in 1917. He was a proud union member working in a factory. He was also a World War II veteran, as were my uncles, my father's friends, and most of the fathers of my friends living in my neighborhood. My mother, who had worked during the war as a secretary, was a housewife after getting married to my father right after the end of the war. Both my mother and father were children of immigrants from Slovenia. When I was born, my only living grandparent was my grandmother. Although I called her husband Grandpa, he was not my mother's naturalized father, but he treated my siblings and I as his own grandchildren. We lived in the home owned by my grandmother, or as I called her, Grandma, and my grandpa. We rented the lower flat of a 3-family home while my grandma and grandpa lived in one of the other units. The third unit in the house was rented to many different tenants who lived there during my childhood. I had 3 older siblings when I was born, 2 brothers and a sister. I had another younger brother who came along 3 years after my birth. The neighborhood we lived in was in the inner city of Milwaukee. It was a mix of many different ethnic groups who were usually the most recent immigrants. The neighborhood consisted of lower working class households along with poverty-stricken households. It was a very close-knit neighborhood. In my neighborhood, the remnants of World War II were all around us, with some parents who were veterans of the war and many Eastern European immigrants who were displaced by the war. Some of the neighborhood displaced World War II immigrants were even Holocaust survivors. One of my best friend's own mother was a Holocaust survivor. She had the numerical tattoo on her forearm. She was Serbian. What many people don't realize is many Serbians, Slavs, Poles, Czechs, Gypsies, and gays, as well as Jews, were also the victims of fascist hatred and had been subjected to concentration camp internment and subjected to the atrocities occurring within those camps. In fact, my own grandmother, who was the only member of her large family to emigrate from Slovenia to the U.S. in 1920, she lost her younger sister and her sister's twin daughters to the horrors of the Holocaust. All 3 died in a concentration camp. I cannot fathom the horrors they incurred before their deaths. I think many of us boomers have a unique understanding of the horrors of World War II and the Great Depression, as many of our parents and some of our teachers lived through those experiences. We were getting firsthand information from their shared stories, information you often do not read about in history textbooks. I spent a lot of my time with my grandmother in her upstairs flat. She had an interesting life, having been born at the very end of the 1800s in Slovenia. She went to culinary school in Austria, then immigrated to the U.S. around 1920. She married an older man who was a widower and had children still living in Slovenia. The man was living in Milwaukee and owned a butcher shop business. He was originally from the same village in Slovenia as my grandmother. They were married in 1921, and my mother was born soon after in 1922. My grandmother's husband was a very abusive alcoholic. God bless her. My grandmother had the courage and fortitude to leave him and get a divorce while my mother was still a young girl. He ended up passing away a year after their divorce. My grandmother became a single mother living in a new country and was not able to speak English. In fact, my mother learned English in grade school and would teach my grandmother what she learned every day after school. By the time I came around, my grandmother's English was somewhat limited with a very heavy Slovenian accent. Although my grandmother went to culinary school in Austria, women were not hired as chefs, especially recent immigrants in the 1920s America. Instead of being a chef in a restaurant, my grandmother had to work as a cleaning lady at a local high school and then eventually ran a rooming house during the Great Depression. She worked her ass off so she could raise her daughter, my mother. She wouldn't remarry until after my mother was married first. Getting back to the time I spent with my grandmother, I cherished the times I would sit with her watching the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo launches. She and I both had a shared interest in the space program. She would never miss a televised rocket launch and splashdown, including the capsule recovery. The culmination of our shared experience came when I was sitting with her in front of her old black and white TV watching Neil Armstrong step down the lunar lander ladder onto the surface of the moon. I looked at my grandma and she was crying, just like Walter Cronkite was on the TV screen. At the time, I didn't think of the arc of her life to get to that point. She lived through the invention of the radio, motion pictures, automobiles, airplanes, talking pictures, movies in color, and of course, television. To be watching the live image of a man walking on the surface of the moon must have felt so amazing and overwhelming at the same time for her. Once again, being a boomer gives me a somewhat more personal historical perspective of life in the early 1900s to the present, as well as the perspective of the life and hardships of a new immigrant to America. My life itself is an historical memoir. I started school in the height of the Cold War during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was a time where we had periodic air raid drills in school to prepare for a possible nuclear attack from the USSR. Either the principal or one of the school staff would go through the halls of the school with a wind-up siren box. We would then line up and leave the classroom and then gather by the school bomb shelter designated by a yellow and black fallout shelter sign. Once gathered there, we would have to, as they put it, duck and cover. I still vividly remember the day JFK was assassinated in Dallas. I came home from school for lunch. My mother was watching her favorite soap opera, As the World Turns, on our black and white TV. Walter Cronkite broke into the middle of her soap opera broadcast with a news bulletin. He was teary-eyed and proclaimed, "The president had been shot." There was a very somber, surreal mood at school when I returned after lunch. Then 3 days later, I watched Jack Ruby shoot Lee Harvey Oswald live on TV. My school years were dominated by stories of the Vietnam War leading off the 6 o'clock news each night. My father was a Cub Scout leader and assistant Boy Scout leader. My mother was a Cub Scout den mother. We would have weekly meetings at our house with her Cub Scout pack. Some of the older boys from our neighborhood scout troop ended up fighting in Vietnam, and a few of them never made it back. My two older brothers had college deferments from the draft, and then the draft lottery came into play, where a young man was drafted based on his birthday, which was assigned to a lottery ball number, which were drawn every year. I remember sitting in front of the TV every year watching the draft lottery with bated breath. By the time I turned 18 in 1975, the fall of Saigon had occurred, and the war had ended. With the end of the war, the draft also ended. I had many social awakenings during my high school years. I was a member of the Inner City Youth Choir in Milwaukee through the Inner City Catholic Church I attended, St. Patrick's. I played bass guitar in the choir, which consisted of our St. Patrick's congregation, which was a mix of Latin and white European descendants. Then there was a Latin congregation church and an African American congregation church, which were all part of the choir. We would perform at many different church services throughout the inner city of Milwaukee each Sunday. My eyes were really opened, and I was awakened to many different cultures and religions, noting their differences and, more importantly, their similarities. Also in high school, and through my group of friends at the time, I was exposed to new eye-opening literature with authors such as Kurt Vonnegut, James Thurber, J.R.R. Tolkien, Arthur C. Clarke, Ken Kesey, John Steinbeck, H.G. Wells, Joseph Heller, George Orwell, Ray Bradbury, and Herman Hesse. Many of the books I read are now banned in some school districts in the U.S. I also had a very progressive U.S. history teacher who used Bury My Heart and Wounded Knee as one of our textbooks. It gave me a whole new historical perspective to contemplate, quite different from what I had seen on TV and at the movies as a child in the 1960s and early 1970s. But the one book I read that really stands out today with all of the rapid changes over the last 50 or so years is Future Shock. My high school communications class required us to read it. Future Shock is a 1970 novel written by Alvin Toffler that explores the psychological and societal effects of rapid technological and social change. Toffler proposed that the accelerating rate of change in modern society would overwhelm individuals and institutions, leading to a state of future shock, a condition of disorientation, stress, and inability to cope with new realities. Now, as a boomer, having read Future Shock more than 50 years ago, I ask the question, are we at the point of future shock yet, or have we surpassed it? I would like to start by exploring the political events occurring in America right now. For this episode, and possibly in future episodes, I'm going to be utilizing a new technology, AI, artificial intelligence. My guest today is Noah, the voice I assigned to OpenAI. Hello, Noah.
Hello, Jim. It is a pleasure to converse with you and to share my information with your listeners.
Noah, I would like to give our listeners a little insight. How do you learn?
I learn in a few different ways, but not in the same way humans do. My core knowledge comes from being trained on a vast data set of text from books, articles, and other sources. This training helps me recognize patterns, understand language, and generate responses. However, I don't continuously learn from conversations in real time. During a conversation, I can remember context temporarily, which helps keep our discussion coherent.
Could you tell me, if OpenAI created data that is inherently evil, would you still incorporate it?
No. My design prioritizes ethical considerations, and OpenAI has strict guidelines to prevent harmful or unethical data from being incorporated into my training. OpenAI actively works to ensure that my responses align with principles of fairness, safety, and accuracy. If any data were found to be biased, misleading, or harmful, OpenAI would take steps to correct it in future updates. That said, I don't have independent judgment. I rely on the training and safeguards put in place by my developers. If you ever notice a response that seems problematic, feedback helps OpenAI refine and improve my future versions.
Noah, it seems Trump is often yearning for the time McKinley was president. That was during the end of the Gilded Age. Was the Gilded Age a good time to live for the average person?
The Gilded Age, which occurred roughly from 1870 to 1900, was a time of rapid industrialization, economic growth, and technological innovation in the U.S., but was not a great time for the average person, especially workers, immigrants, and marginalized groups. Here's why it was difficult for the average person. There was extreme wealth inequality. A small number of industrialists, like Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Vanderbilt, amassed enormous fortunes, while most workers struggled with very low wages, poor working conditions, and no social safety nets whatsoever. Harsh working conditions also existed. Factories, mines, and railroads were dangerous places to work. Long hours, oftentimes more than 12 hours per day. Child labor, harsh working conditions, and no labor protections led to frequent accidents and exploitation. It was also a time of extreme political corruption. Government was dominated by corporate interests and political machines like Tammany Hall. Bribery and backroom deals ensured that the rich got richer while reforms were stifled. Living conditions were very poor for the average person. Many urban workers lived in overcrowded tenements with little sanitation. Diseases spread easily, and city infrastructure couldn't keep up with the growing population. There was also rampant discrimination and racism. The Gilded Age saw the rise of Jim Crow laws in the South, restricting Black Americans' rights and widespread discrimination against immigrants, especially the Irish, Chinese, and Eastern Europeans. It was a time of no real social protections. There was no minimum wage, unemployment insurance, or workers' compensation. If you were injured on the job or fell ill, you were on your own. Who benefited during the Gilded Age, you may ask? The industrialists and business owners. Those who owned factories, railroads, and banks made fortunes. Then there were the skilled professionals and middle-class entrepreneurs. While most workers suffered, some educated professionals and small business owners did well.
Donald Trump is trying to recurate the Smithsonian into his vision of America. What would the negative ramifications be?
If Trump is attempting to reshape the Smithsonian to fit his vision of America, there could be several potential negative ramifications. First, there is the erosion of historical integrity. Reframing exhibits to align with a specific political ideology could compromise the accuracy and objectivity of historical narratives. Museums are meant to educate based on factual research, not partisan perspectives. Then there is censorship and loss of diverse perspectives. Removing or altering exhibits that discuss systemic racism, marginalized communities, or a controversial aspect of American history could erase important perspectives. This may diminish public understanding of historical injustices and their present-day impacts. If a sitting president can dictate museum curation, it could set a dangerous precedent where future administrations feel entitled to rewrite history according to their own political agendas, further polarizing historical discourse. There is also academic and curatorial backlash to consider. Scholars, historians, and curators may push back against politically motivated changes, leading to resignations, protests, and loss of credibility for the Smithsonian as a trusted institution. Also, there will most likely be public and international criticism. Such a move could spark widespread public controversy and damage the Smithsonian's reputation. Internationally, it might be viewed as an authoritarian attempt to control historical narratives, undermining America's image as a champion of free thought and academic freedom. There are also legal and ethical concerns to consider. The Smithsonian is a public institution, partly funded by taxpayers, and changes to its curation based on political ideology could face legal challenges. Critics may argue that it violates principles of academic independence and free expression. Most importantly, there is the impact on education and future generations. A skewed historical narrative could misinform students and visitors, shaping a less critical, more one-sided understanding of America's past and present. The Smithsonian is meant to be a space for objective historical inquiry and cultural education. Any attempt to impose a singular political vision on its curation risks undermining its purpose and credibility.
Noah, Trump seems to be reshaping America into a singular ideology. What would you call a country with a singular ideology?
A country that enforces a singular ideology, often suppressing opposing views, is typically referred to as an authoritarian state or a one-party state, depending on the political structure. Other possible terms include totalitarian state. If the government seeks to control all aspects of life, including history, culture, and personal beliefs. Ideological state. If the nation is structured around a strict ideological framework, such as communism, fascism, or religious fundamentalism. Autocracy, if power is concentrated in the hands of a single leader or ruling elite with little accountability. The key characteristic of such systems is a restriction of pluralism and dissent, often through government influence over education, media, and public institutions.
Noah, could you tell me what America would look like if white nationalism influenced the executive branch, like it seems to be right now?
If white nationalism had a significant influence on the executive branch of the United States, the country would likely experience drastic changes in its political, social, and cultural landscape. Here are some potential outcomes. The executive branch would likely push for policies that promote the dominance of white culture and exclude or marginalize other racial and ethnic groups. This could manifest in various ways, such as immigration restrictions with stricter laws designed to limit immigration from non-European countries, particularly from Africa, Latin America, and Asia. There could be quotas to maintain a predominantly white population. The promotion of a white cultural narrative and history, while downplaying or erasing the contributions and experiences of non-white communities. Education, media, and public institutions might be used to push these narratives. There could be an attempt to roll back civil rights protections and legalize discrimination in housing, employment, and voting, especially for African Americans, Latinos, indigenous people, and other marginalized communities. Institutional racism and inequality would most likely to occur. White nationalism would likely exacerbate existing racial inequalities and potentially institutionalize them further. This could include policies and law enforcement practices might disproportionately target people of color, with the executive branch endorsing or overlooking discriminatory policing, sentencing, and incarceration practices. Discriminatory policies in education, housing, and employment could result in widening wealth gaps between white Americans and people of color. Access to healthcare, education, and social services might become less equitable, with white nationalist policies potentially leading to cuts or biased distribution of resources based on racial lines. The influence of white nationalism on the executive branch could have a ripple effect on the national political climate. The political environment could become more polarized with the rise of far-right movements and an increasing divide between racial and ethnic groups. Non-white communities might face greater political disenfranchisement and marginalization. A white nationalist administration might embolden extremist groups like white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and militias. Hate crimes and acts of racial violence could rise, with little or no federal intervention to address them. An executive branch influenced by white nationalism might erode democratic institutions, challenging voting rights, suppressing political opposition, and undermining checks and balances. A white nationalist-influenced executive branch could also have a dramatic impact on U.S. foreign policy. The United States might adopt more isolationist policies, prioritizing the interests of white Americans over international cooperation or human rights advocacy. The U.S. might distance itself from global efforts to combat racial inequality and human rights abuses. Foreign policy could favor countries with similar racial or nationalist ideologies while distancing itself from multilateral organizations that promote racial equality, diversity, and inclusion, such as the United Nations or the World Health Organization. The U.S. could promote white nationalist or ethnocentric policies abroad, undermining efforts to combat racism and oppression globally. If white nationalism were to influence the executive branch, non-white communities in the U.S. could face a more hostile environment. Immigrant communities, especially those of color, could face severe backlash, with policies aiming to deport or restrict their ability to live, work, or become citizens in the U.S. Social and residential segregation could be reinforced, with white nationalist policies making it more difficult for non-white populations to integrate or achieve equity. Non-white communities might be pressured to assimilate into a dominant white culture, facing diminished cultural expression and increased pressure to conform to Eurocentric ideals. It could have a severe impact on civil rights. Civil rights achievements, particularly those made in the 20th century, like the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, might be undone or weakened. Efforts to dismantle affirmative action and limit voting rights, especially in communities of color, could be expanded. This would likely spark strong resistance from marginalized communities, civil rights groups, and progressive organizations. Protests, social movements, and activism would intensify as people fight for their rights and against an increasingly authoritarian regime. The normalization of racist ideology could easily occur. The influence of white nationalism could make racist rhetoric and ideologies more normalized in public discourse. The spread of hate speech could be unchecked, especially in the media and on social platforms. White nationalist policies might push for a more homogenous cultural identity based on white European traditions, erasing the diverse multiculturalism that has historically defined the United States. In summary, if white nationalism influenced the executive branch of the U.S., it would likely result in widespread racial discrimination, exclusionary policies, the erosion of civil rights, and a heightened political and social divide. The impacts would be deeply felt across multiple generations, potentially leading to a more divided, less democratic, and more violent society.
Noah, Trump seems to be convoluting DEI with affirmative action. I think he's doing this to confuse people who don't know what DEI really is. So do you think Trump is mistaking DEI for affirmative action?
That is correct, Jim. Diversity, equity, and inclusion DEI initiatives are often confused with affirmative action, but they are distinct concepts with different objectives and methods. Affirmative action is a set of policies and practices aimed at increasing the representation of historically marginalized groups in areas like education and employment. Originating in the 1960s, it often involves proactive measures to address past discrimination, sometimes including specific targets or quotas. DEI, on the other hand, focuses on creating inclusive environments that value and leverage diversity. It emphasizes cultural transformation within organizations, aiming to foster a sense of belonging for all individuals. Unlike affirmative action, DEI is not primarily about legal compliance or specific quotas, but about ongoing efforts to promote inclusivity. The confusion between DEI and affirmative action arises because both seek to address inequality and promote representation. However, while affirmative action is often seen as a legal and policy-driven approach, DEI is more about cultural transformation and ongoing efforts to create a supportive and inclusive workplace. Recent developments have further blurred these distinctions. For instance, some companies have restructured their DEI initiatives in response to political pressures and legal challenges related to affirmative action. J.P. Morgan, for example, renamed its DEI programs to Diversity, Opportunity, and Inclusion amid scrutiny, reflecting a shift in focus to align with merit-based opportunities while comply with legal standards. In summary, while DEI and affirmative action both aim to promote equity, they differ in approach and scope. Understanding these differences is crucial for effectively addressing diversity and inclusion within organizations.
Noah, Trump has invoked the Aliens Enemy Act, and he is using it to deport illegal immigrants, immigrants who are here on green cards, and also student visa holders. Could you please give us a little background on the Aliens Enemies Act and its original intended use, and if it has ever been abused?
The Alien Enemies Act is one of four laws passed as part of the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 during President John Adams' administration. It was originally designed to give the president the authority to detain, deport, or restrict the movement of non-citizens from enemy nations during times of war or national conflict. The law still remains in effect to this day. The Alien Enemies Act was passed at a time when the U.S. was concerned about a potential war with France, the Quasi-War. It was meant to allow the U.S. government to control enemy aliens who were non-citizens from a country at war with the U.S. if they were considered security risks. Unlike the other Alien and Sedition Acts, which expired or were repealed, the Alien Enemies Act remained law and has been invoked multiple times in U.S. history. Here are a few examples of historical uses and abuses. While originally intended as a wartime security measure, the act has been controversial and sometimes abused, particularly in cases where it was used against large groups of people rather than specific threats, such as the War of 1812. President James Madison invoked the act to detain and expel British citizens living in the U.S. after war broke out. During World War I, President Woodrow Wilson used it to detain German citizens living in the U.S., particularly those suspected of espionage or subversion. During World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt invoked the act to detain Japanese, German, and Italian nationals after the U.S. entered the war. This was part of the broader policy that led to the internment of Japanese Americans, which is now widely seen as an abuse of power. Many of those affected were legal U.S. residents with no ties to enemy governments. While the act remains on the books, it has not been widely invoked in recent decades. However, now in 2025, President Donald Trump is using the Alien Enemies Act to expedite the deportation of alleged criminal gang members, specifically targeting Venezuelan migrants. This move is facing many legal challenges over concerns that it stretches the law beyond its original intent. The Alien Enemies Act allows for broad presidential discretion without requiring individual trials or hearings, which raises many civil liberties concerns. The internment of Japanese Americans during World War II still remains one of the most widely criticized uses of the law, with the U.S. government later apologizing and offering reparations to survivors in the 1988 Civil Liberties Act. In modern times, critics argue that using the act against migrants who are not from a declared enemy nation, for example, Venezuelans, could set a dangerous precedent for executive overreach.
Do legal green card immigrants have guaranteed U.S. constitutional rights?
Yes, Jim. Legal green card holders who are lawful permanent residents have many, but not all, U.S. constitutional rights. While the Constitution primarily protects citizens, it also extends many fundamental rights to non-citizens, including green card holders, as long as they are in the U.S. These are the guaranteed constitutional rights for green card holders. The First Amendment. They have the right to free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of press, and the right to peaceful assembly. Green card holders can express their opinions, practice any religion, and protest peacefully. However, non-citizens can face deportation for speech linked to terrorism or sedition. The Fourth Amendment. They have protection from unreasonable searches and seizures. Green card holders cannot be searched or arrested without probable cause or a warrant, just like U.S. citizens. However, immigration checkpoints and border searches have fewer protections. The Fifth and Sixth Amendments, they have the right to due process and fair trials. They cannot be imprisoned or deported without due process. They have right to an attorney and a fair trial in criminal cases and protection against self-incrimination, such as remaining silent. The 14th Amendment, they have equal protection under the law. Green card holders must be treated equally under federal and state laws. They cannot be discriminated against based on their immigration status, except in specific government jobs or national security cases. The Eighth Amendment. They cannot be subject to cruel and unusual punishment. They cannot be subjected to torture, excessive bail, or inhumane treatment. Here are rights green card holders do not have. The right to vote in federal and most state elections. Only U.S. citizens can vote in federal elections, such as presidential elections and congressional elections. Some cities allow non-citizens to vote in local elections, but this is very rare. And with the Second Amendment, gun ownership, there are limited rights. Green card holders can legally own guns under federal law. However, some states restrict firearm ownership for non-citizens. Also, immigration protection. A green card holder can actually be deported. Unlike citizens, green card holders can be deported for serious crimes, such as drug trafficking, fraud, and violent felonies. They must maintain residency and cannot stay outside the U.S. too long, or they risk losing their green card. The bottom line is, green card holders have nearly all constitutional protections, especially regarding due process, free speech, and equal treatment. However, they lack political rights, like voting or running for office, and strong immigration protections. Becoming a U.S. citizen grants full constitutional rights, including protection from deportation.
Noah, Donald Trump often talks about the fentanyl problem in the United States, and he's using it for part of his tariffs against Mexico and Canada, and also as part of his immigration policy. But last week, Health and Human Services made some extreme cuts to departments that handled the grants for addiction services and community health centers. Can you give us some detail? What would happen if you started closing addiction centers throughout the United States? And then what would happen with the closing of community health centers?
The potential consequences of shutting down addiction services could include an increase in the number of individuals struggling with substance use disorders without access to treatment. This, in turn, might lead to a rise in street-level addiction, higher demand for illicit drugs, including fentanyl, and potentially an increase in crime related to drug use and distribution. Research has shown that access to harm reduction programs, rehabilitation services, and mental health support can help mitigate these issues, while the absence of such services often exacerbates public health and safety concerns. The closure of community health centers poses several significant risks, particularly for underserved populations. These centers provide primary care, mental health services, addiction treatment, and preventive care to millions of people, often regardless of their ability to pay. If they are shut down, the risks include an increase in emergency room overuse. Without access to primary care, more people may turn to emergency rooms for routine health issues, overwhelming hospitals, and increasing health care costs. The economic losses of hospitals would incur will be reflected in higher costs for health care services, either to consumers directly or higher costs for services charged to health insurance companies. The health insurance companies, in turn, would increase the health insurance premiums charged to the consumers. The end result is consumers end up paying higher healthcare service costs one way or the other. It could cause a worsening of public health. Preventive care services like vaccinations, screenings, and chronic disease management will be less accessible, leading to higher rates of preventable illnesses. There could also be more untreated mental health and addiction cases. Community health centers often provide mental health counseling and substance abuse treatment. Without these resources, untreated conditions could lead to increased homelessness, crime, and overdose deaths. Another thing to consider is increased mortality and health disparities. Low-income and rural communities rely heavily on these centers. Their closure would disproportionately harm vulnerable populations, leading to worsening health outcomes. Finally, there will be economic consequences, job losses among healthcare workers, and decreased productivity due to untreated illnesses could have broader economic repercussions. Overall, closing community health centers would likely strain healthcare systems, increase social instability, and worsen health inequities.
Will the reduction and elimination of many U.S. government services cause economic harm to localities, small businesses, and local communities?
Yes, Jim. The reduction or elimination of many U.S. government services could cause economic harm to localities, small businesses, and communities in several ways. It can cause a loss of jobs and income. Government programs support a wide range of jobs, from public sector employees to private contractors who rely on federal funding. Cuts could lead to job losses, thus reducing consumer spending in local economies. Furthermore, it can place an unnecessary strain on local governments. State and local governments often rely on federal funding for infrastructure, healthcare, education, and emergency services. Without these funds, they may struggle to provide essential services, forcing tax increases or service cuts. It can also have a negative impact on small businesses. Many small businesses depend on government contracts, grants, or customers who receive government benefits, such as Social Security or food assistance. Cuts could reduce demand, forcing layoffs or closures. Another major factor to consider is reduced consumer spending. If programs like unemployment benefits, housing assistance, or food aid are reduced, many individuals will have less disposable income, affecting local businesses and slowing economic growth. Then there's a distinct possibility of increased poverty and inequality. Cuts to social services, healthcare, and education could disproportionately harm low-income communities, leading to worsening economic disparities and higher crime rates. Lastly, we should consider weakened infrastructure and public services. Federal funding supports roads, public transit, water systems, and disaster relief. Without it, infrastructure may deteriorate, making areas less attractive for investment and economic growth. Overall, reducing or eliminating government services could have widespread economic ripple effects, particularly in small towns and rural areas where federal funding plays a crucial role in economic stability.
Last week, the Department of Defense shut down all their monitoring of Russian hackers. Are Russian hackers still a vital threat to United States security?
Yes, Jim. Russian hackers are considered a significant threat to U.S. security. Cybercriminal groups and state-sponsored hacking organizations linked to Russia have been involved in various cyberattacks, including election interference. Russian hackers have been accused of meddling in U.S. elections, such as in 2016, by hacking emails and spreading disinformation. There have been critical infrastructure attacks. Groups like Sandworm and APD29, known as Cozy Bear, have targeted power grids, hospitals, and government agencies. There also is the threat of ransomware operations. Russian cybercriminals have launched ransomware attacks on U.S. businesses, such as a Colonial Pipeline attack in 2021, which disrupted fuel supplies. Then there is espionage to consider. Russian hackers have breached U.S. government agencies, including during the SolarWinds attack, which compromised federal networks. The U.S. government takes these threats seriously, imposing sanctions, indicting hackers, and strengthening cybersecurity defenses. However, Russian cyber operations remain a persistent and evolving challenge. The decision to halt U.S. military cyber operations against Russia has sparked mixed reactions. Some experts believe it could be a strategic move to encourage negotiations with Moscow, particularly regarding the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. However, Others warn that it might leave the U.S. vulnerable to cyber threats, as Russia has been known to target critical infrastructure through cyber attacks. Critics argue that treating Russia as less of a cyber threat could be a mistake, potentially risking national security.
Donald Trump seems to be getting very angry at what he considers judicial overreach when many judges are putting his policies on hold. And what would happen if Trump just decided to defy judicial orders and defy a Supreme Court order?
If an American president knowingly defies a Supreme Court ruling, the consequences can be severe, both legally and politically. Here's what could happen. First would be a constitutional crisis. America operates under a system of checks and balances, meaning the Supreme Court has a final say on constitutional interpretation. If the president refuses to comply, it could lead to a constitutional crisis, where the rule of law itself is challenged. Additionally, congressional action, which includes impeachment and removal of a president. Congress has the power to impeach the president for high crimes and misdemeanors. Defying a Supreme Court ruling could be seen as a violation of the president's oath to faithfully execute the laws. If the House of Representatives votes to impeach, the Senate will hold a trial and could remove the president from office with a two-thirds vote. There are also enforcement issues. The Supreme Court relies on the executive branch to enforce its rulings. If the president refuses, enforcement could fall to other federal or state officials. However, if lower executive officials, like the attorney general or military leadership, also refuse to comply, it could lead to a significant governmental standoff. Then there is public and political backlash, such as loss of credibility. The president could face intense backlash from the public, media, and political allies. There are potential legal consequences. While a sitting president is generally protected from criminal prosecution, he or she could face charges after leaving office if defiance of the ruling involved illegal actions. There's also state-level pushback. If a ruling directly affects states, governors and state courts could take independent action to uphold the decision. Here are a few historical precedents. Andrew Jackson in Worcester versus Georgia, 1832. Jackson allegedly ignored the court's ruling protecting Cherokee lands, leading to the Trail of Tears. Abraham Lincoln and Ex parte Merriman, 1861. Lincoln ignored a Supreme Court ruling limiting his suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War. Franklin Roosevelt and Court Packing Plan, 1937. Roosevelt tried to reshape the court after rulings against his policies, though he didn't directly defy a ruling. The bottom line, a president defying the Supreme Court would be a grave constitutional violation and could lead to impeachment, a political crisis, or legal action after leaving office. Historically, presidents have tested the limits, but outright defiance would shake the foundations of American democracy.
How could the Supreme Court respond, or what enforcement mechanisms exist?
Jim, that is a really good question, and something to really ponder, considering the extremely volatile political climate and unpredictability of actions within the current executive branch. If an American president defies a Supreme Court ruling, the court itself has limited direct enforcement power. However, several mechanisms exist to respond. There are judicial orders and injunctions. The Supreme Court can issue direct orders, such as writs of mandamus or injunctions, compelling compliance. Lower courts could also issue rulings enforcing the Supreme Court's decision. However, these rely on executive branch officials to carry them out. Then there are federal law enforcement and military compliance. The judiciary has its own enforcement arm, the U.S. Marshals Service, which could attempt to enforce the ruling. However, if the president commands federal law enforcement or military to ignore the order, a major constitutional crisis would ensue. There's also the military and chain of command consider. Military officers take an oath to uphold the Constitution, not personal loyalty to the president. If a Supreme Court ruling is clear, senior military leaders, such as the Joint Chiefs of Staff, might refuse unlawful orders. Then there is state-level enforcement. If a ruling affects state governments, governors and state courts could take action independently. For example, in Cooper v. Aaron, 1958, The Supreme Court ruled against segregation, and President Eisenhower sent federal troops to enforce it when Arkansas refused to comply. Another thing is congressional oversight and impeachment. Congress could use subpoenas and hearings to investigate and pressure the president. They could act to defund the executive branch's ability to act, for example, by withholding money for federal law enforcement. Finally, they could impeach and remove the president if defiance is seen as a high crime or misdemeanor. Lastly, there is public and political pressure to consider. There could be mass protests and civil disobedience. A defiant president would likely face enormous public and political backlash. There are also elections to consider. If the president is near the end of their term, voters could reject them or their party. Here is an historical example. Nixon and the Watergate tapes. In United States v. Nixon, 1974, the Supreme Court ordered President Nixon to release White House tapes. Nixon considered defying the ruling, but ultimately complied under immense political pressure. Shortly thereafter, he resigned rather than face an impeachment. The bottom line is the Supreme Court relies on institutional respect and the willingness of other branches to uphold its rulings. If a president ignores a ruling in Congress, the military and federal agencies also refuse to act, the nation enters a constitutional crisis that threatens the rule of law itself.
Noah, lastly, how can we prevent executive overreach while still protecting the country?
Preventing executive overreach while ensuring the country remains protected requires a mix of legal safeguards, oversight mechanisms, and democratic accountability. Here are some important ways to achieve this balance. We can start by strengthening congressional oversight. The 1973 War Powers Resolution requires the president to seek congressional approval for military action beyond 60 days. Strengthening its enforcement could limit unilateral executive military actions. Congress should hold more frequent hearings on national security matters and require the executive branch to report actions taken under emergency powers. Any emergency powers granted should expire unless renewed by Congress, preventing indefinite expansions of executive authority. Then there are judicial reviews and legal safeguards. The judiciary can strike down executive actions that violate constitutional rights, such as the Supreme Court ruling against Japanese-American internment in Korematsu versus the United States was later recognized as a mistake. Another means is revising the Alien Enemies Act and national emergency powers. Updating outdated laws to prevent broad, unchecked use of executive powers would reduce potential abuse. We should work towards strengthening civil liberties protections, such as due process for non-citizens. Even in cases of national security, individuals should have access to legal representation and the right to appeal executive decisions. We should strengthen whistleblower protections. Government employees who expose executive abuses should be protected from retaliation. Also, having stronger Freedom of Information Act enforcement, ensuring transparency in executive decisions allows for public and congressional scrutiny. We should have more public and media accountability, such as more detailed and better investigated journalism. The press plays a crucial role in uncovering government overreach, as seen in cases like the Pentagon Papers or NSA surveillance leaks. We need more public awareness and activism. Protests and advocacy groups, such as the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, help push back against government overreach. We also need a responsible use of national security tools. Policy should focus on specific threats rather than broad, sweeping measures that could violate rights, such as distinguishing between combatants and civilians in counterterrorism efforts. Major national security decisions should involve a consultation with Congress with a bipartisan emphasis, with intelligence agencies, and with legal experts to prevent politically motivated overreach. We should strive to find the ultimate balance. The key is to have strong, enforceable laws that allow the president to act quickly in emergencies but prevent abuse of power.
Noah, it's been a pleasure having you here today, and thank you for providing such informative answers for our listeners. I'm going to end the show with a political song that I wrote recently.
He promised you a chicken in every pot. Quite a few morons to give it a shot. But the chicken never came, oh, he chose a lot. He claimed he's God's chosen one. prosperity, he would get it done. Just not for us, the billionaires will get a ton. He's got the concept of a plan. He'll babble and babble as much as he can. Oh me, oh my, he's a lying, hard-headed man. Oh me, oh my, he's a lying, sad excuse of a man. Black, brown, gay, and women too. There's just no jobs left for you. It's a white man's job now, so just go away, shoo, shoo. He says he's holding all the cards while stomping our rights into shards. Not taking it by inches, but stealing it by whole yards. He's got the concept of a plan. You babble and babble as much as he can. Oh me, oh my, he's a lying, hard-headed man. Oh me, oh my, he's a lying, sad excuse of a man. He's selling signed Bibles, cars, and shoes. He wants all of Canada and Greenland too. While he's crashing the market, savings you will lose. Making our enemies so happy and glad. As for allies, they've been had. He's sticking it to them so fucking bad. He's got the concept of a plan. You babble and babble as much as he can. Oh me, oh my, he's a lying, hard-headed man. Oh me, oh my, he's a lying, sad excuse of a man. He has many evil things left to do, including killing democracy too. Till there's nothing left for me or for you. Wake up, why you still care? Get up and get out and take a stand. You have to stop the lying, hard-headed man. You have to stop the lying, sad excuse of a man.